Recording.
Are you ready, Beth?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to do an intro first, and then we'll get into
okay. And if things like that planes are too loud, then you can just close that door.
Oh. Okay, I might do that.
Yeah. I was just thinking, because that happens a lot, being so close to the airport. Oh.
Yeah, Bethel's noisy. I was in Nikolai at Danny's size. Pretending, visiting Dora, his mom, so cute. But it's amazing. I just kept saying, it's so quiet here.
Yeah.
So quiet.
Compared to.
Yeah.
Compared to Bethel.
Okay.
All right, now we're ready.
Okay.
So today we're here with Beverly Hoffman. Thank you for meeting with us today. My name is Jen Peeks, and I'm here with my project partner, Alice Bailey, in Bethel, Alaska, on July 21. 2018. A little bit about myself. I moved to Bethel in 2004 and first worked as a school social worker at the Lower Kuskokwim School District and then later at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Kuskokwim campus. I now work as the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group Coordinator and Western Region Board Support Coordinator with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And this is how, well, I've known you for a long time, Beb.
I know.
That's not really how I got to know you. I've known you also in the working group.
Yes.
These interviews are part of a senior project for an undergraduate degree in fisheries at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The interviews are not connected to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Fish and Game will have no influence on this project at all. Alice Bailey is currently an assistant professor of photography at the University of Virginia, and she was a former working group coordinator and also knew you from there during that time. The purpose of this project is to document your knowledge and experiences with the Kuskokwim River salmon fishery and its management. And we really appreciate your stories and sharing
your
information. So we will not ask you to answer anything that's too personal or too private. You can stop the interview at any time. Since these interviews will be archived at UAF, they will be available for anyone to listen to.
Okay.
They may also be available electronically on the internet. They're trying to move to more internet-based archiving. So only share what you're comfortable sharing with the public. And again, you don't have to answer any questions that you feel uncomfortable answering.
Okay.
Each interview usually takes 1 to 2 hours, but we can always stop earlier. But that's kind of a long time.
Yeah, it's kind of a long time for my leg situation, mostly.
We can definitely, and we can take breaks as well.
Okay.
Let's see. So, yeah, let us know if you need to pause or stop.
Okay, sure.
Take a break, or if there's anything you need to be more comfortable.
Okay.
We already went over the two consent forms. One was telling you what the project was. The other one was for archiving it at UAM.
Okay.
So do you have any questions?
No, let's go for it, Jan.
So can you tell me your full English name and if you have a Yupik name?
Okay. Beverly Ann Hoffman, Wingagimuchta Kiki Gakflu.
Okay. Were you named after somebody?
Gimuchichta is one who works with dogs because I was a dog musher.
Okay.
And that was given to me by Sophie Alexi in Yupik class. And Kikigak is the late Nick Lupi gave it to me. It was his sister. I love it.
And tell me about your family.
Well, the native side of me, the Yupik side of me, my dad is James Hoffman. He was born and raised here. His father was George, an Englishman. Hoffman sounds German, but anyway, came up looking for gold, ended up opening a trading post in Napaimute. And he died when Dad was 8. My dad's mother, who was the second Mrs. George Hoffman, died shortly after childbirth. So Dad was raised by different siblings in different villages. Mom was non-native. She might say, I'm not Alaskan native, but I am native Alaskan. And her parents were gold seekers also, and they ended up raising her in the Nyack Hills, and then they opened a lodge here in Bethel, and Mom and Dad met when she was 18 and he was not that much older, and they had 9 children, and I'm third in line of 9.
And have you lived in Bethel then your whole life?
I lived, I'm born and raised in Bethel. In 10th grade, my father was a bush pilot, and he had an opportunity to fly F-27s. Moved the whole family to Anchorage when I was in 10th grade, and I thought I was so devastated. I graduated from Diamond High School. Then I thought, whoa, there's a whole world out here, and I headed to Florida with a friend to go to junior college. In 75, I was living in San Francisco with a bunch of folks, and we decided to come up, make a bunch of money one summer in Bethel, Alaska. We worked our way up on a boat from Seattle and lived in tents all summer. And at the end of it, my boyfriend, who's my husband now, John McDonald, decided he died and went to heaven living in Bethel, Alaska, and loved everything Kuskokwim. And he didn't want to go back to San Francisco. And I'm going, like, oh, my God. Anyway, we're here. We raised our children here.
And how many children do you have?
2. Colin is 40. Casey is 30. And they're both lucky to be alive. My husband talked me into both of them. I don't mind saying all that stuff. Whatever. Anyway.
So what was your childhood like growing up?
Oh, my gosh. When Alaska became a state, Bethel was only 1,000 people in 1959. I was 8 years old. Everything was on the river here in Bethel. If you were going to the graveyard, which is now by AC store, you were really going way out of town. It was a real unique experience growing up. No television, no running water, no flush toilets. Of course, you know, all the internet and social media. I mean, it was just a different life back then in some ways. But in other ways, things are the same. And we'll probably get into that. But the Catholics seem to live closer to Brown Slough, and the Moravians lived, you know, the Moravians settled in Bethel in 1884 on the High Bluff, which quickly eroded. And so they were uptown and we were upriver and they were more downriver. And those two churches were big in everybody's lives. And the Air Force Base was across the river where the airport was, and life was real different. Bethel's very diverse, and it was diverse back then, too. It was primarily Yupik Eskimo. Of course, in the villages, majority Yupik Eskimo. But Bethel, you know, started having just all sorts of different kinds of people that made it interesting then and still interesting today.
Sir, so for people who don't know the Kuskokwim area or the Bethel area, can you kind of describe what this area is like?
Well, we're 90 miles in from the Bering Sea. The Kuskokwim River is the second largest river in Alaska, 8th in the United States, the only unimpeded river in the United States, meaning there's no dams, no bridges. And we're 400 miles west of Anchorage. Is that what you're talking about? 400 miles west of Anchorage off the road system. And when you say that to people, I live 400 miles west of Anchorage off the road system, you mean you can't drive there? No, you can take a boat there, but there's no transportation boats, but we count on the river for everything, getting goods from Seattle, our food sources, our way to get to this village and that village, whether it be winter or summer. And Bethel is just the hub of it all and has always been like that. It's been sort of the center of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, you know, just the biggest hub. And I really feel lucky to have been born and raised here. And now that I'm coming out of my elder in training and moving more into the elder status, I'm really glad I have that history here.
And describe the land, what the land is like.
Okay. Some people say it's flat. I say it's not. We live rolling tundra country. And there's space, openness, and lots of water. And I love that in my adult life, I've discovered all those wonders of this area, the wonders of the river, the wonders of the land. 241 species of birds come back here to nest from the Amazon, Antarctica, all over. And then we have, even in the bad years, we have a wonderful fishery of many different types of species. The land provides us greens and berries, and all of this makes for very unique people. When you're gathering and you're collecting wood that comes from way up rivers so that you have winter wood and smoke wood for your fish house, you know. So we have this openness, yet along the river, there's trees. But if you go beyond those trees, it's all open tundra till you get to the mountains, which are about 100 miles away, where the tributaries are, where the salmon spawn. And we're really lucky to live here. Anybody who lives here that doesn't feel that they're lucky, even with all of our blemishes and issues, I still feel that way.
So what are your joys in life? What,
oh my God.
What do you most enjoy doing when you have free time or spare time?
All time is spare time. I'm a gardener, I'm a fisher, I'm a boat driver, I'm a advocate in the community, an activist. I'm really feel that it's important for people like myself to speak out against open pit mines. It's really important to speak out that we need to protect our food sources so that it's sustainable for years to come, for generations to come. I love biking and hiking, although I can't wait till I can hike again. I love that we have a swimming pool here now, something I worked for all my adult life. Because we live on the second largest river, I just felt like a lot of other, mostly mothers, that we need not only to teach our kids to swim, but to have healthy outlets when we see all of these crazy things that, maybe negative things, you need positive things to offset it. So the things that I like to do fill me with joy and, you know, just I work at that, finding positive things to do that bring me joy. So that's fishing and berry picking and gardening and reading and visiting and I won't say going to meetings giving me great joy, but I spend seems like time in meetings. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about subsistence. What does subsistence mean to you?
It's, I didn't grow up in a true subsistence family. And it's rare to find that true subsistence person anymore because we depend on cash to do these things. But when, what's really interesting, people will say, oh, it's so expensive to live in the Waikiki Delta. Oh, how can people live there? So I say you need to know how to live there. You need to know how to gather. For me, my freezer needs to have fish in it. My freezer needs to have birds in it. It needs to have moose in it. It needs to have berries. I need to make sure I have jars in the pantry of all those things too. I need to make sure that I have potatoes that'll last all year long. I still cook with a wood stove, and I need wood. So it's gathering things that help you live this way of life that generations of our people were so dependent on all these resources. And that's why it's so important. There was years where the people starved because maybe the fish didn't come in or the berries didn't come back. And there were times of want. And so today, it's so much easier than it was when, say, before Western civilization came in. It's easier in some ways to gather these resources. Subsistence is so important. If you're going to live out here, you need to be a gatherer. You need to know how to gather. You need to not be so dependent upon money. Some people come here just for the money. It's a great place to make money. In Bethel, I'm not talking about the outlying communities. I've never made a lot of money in my life, but I feel rich because of the resources that allow me to live here. And I feel rich in the knowledge that was shared with me so that I knew how to do these things.
Was there somebody who taught you how to do some of these things? Or how did you learn to be a gatherer?
Oh, my gosh. Like I said, I grew up third in line of nine, but my folks were both working, and we counted. We put up our freezer fish, but our smoked fish we got from my Aunt Mary and Uncle Dutu, maybe some from Uncle Eddie. So who taught me? I moved home. I was 24, and a wonderful man by the name of Elias Venus kind of took us in. We were living in tents and talk of the town in 1975 at the old Fox Farm. And we wanted to learn how to put up fish. And Elias Venus said, I will show you. So some people smoke with alder. Elias smoked with cottonwood. So I do my cold smoke strips because Elias told me how to do that, and this is what I prefer. And it's really interesting. So you know how to pick berries, you know how to gather berries, but the power plant burnt down that year. I decided winter 1975, and we had a wood stove. So when we built our new home, there was no way we were not going to have a wood stove. And so then I learned how to make log rafts with my husband. We'd go out and gather logs. We just learned on our own those type of things. Somebody that first summer lent us a rotten old fish net because they didn't trust us with a good one, and it split, but we learned how to drift down the river, you know, and put up fish. And gardening, people like Chrissy Shantz, Janet Kaiser's mother, and my grandmother and Alice Nervy and people like that, they were the gardeners in town when I was a little girl. And so that's why I garden today and enjoy gardening. And you learn, like I worked for Cooperative Extension for 9 years. And Cooperative Extension is part of the University of Alaska. and it was farm-based at first. It was land grant. And, man, if you want to learn anything, and you can often turn to cooperative extension for, how to jar fish, you know, and how to make yogurt and all that kind of good stuff. Yeah, a lot of people. And I like to think that I am doing that for people younger than me, my kids and other folks. Did I teach you how to plant flowers? Did I teach you how to pull weeds? Did I teach you how to cut fish? And, you know, just, I love it when I see knowledge passed on. And I don't do anything traditionally. I mean, I'm sort of an unorthodox, multi-mix person that lives here. You know, you speak in Norwegian and German and God knows what else.
So, were there any stories that were passed on to you about fishing when you were learning how to fish with, and Elias was teaching you how to put up fish? Was there any stories that they shared or teachings that they shared?
We took for granted fish, that the fish would always return. That was the story. In the spring, the fish will come. We'll start with the smelts. We have our all-winter fish. But it was just something we took for granted, that we'd always have king salmon. We'd always have the chum and the silvers. And as far as stories, I don't know that we sat around and talked fish stories, you know, about... It just was something that was just part of our life, and that my dad and mom with 9 kids, we ate fish Monday through Saturday, and on Sunday we were lucky if we got chicken, you know, and just that it was a very important part of our diet, that without it, you know, you couldn't survive. You were dependent on it. And I think the importance of it as a kid growing up, you know, you just know that, oh my God, fish again, you know. It's like, and I have siblings that won't eat charred fish and fish patties because they said I made it so horrible. Well, it was kind of plain, you know, but we ate fish every kind of way, and I even eat in more ways today. So, I don't know if I answered your question, but I have no idea. But
do you have a favorite fish species that you like to eat, or of the fish that's your favorite?
I will tell you this about my dad growing up. Fish heads. I know it's like everybody. No stink heads, just fish heads. I'm not a stink head person. I haven't gone that far in my, you know, expanding my horizons. I love all fish. I love whitefish and smelts and sheafish and all the salmons. And I appreciate all the different species even more today, because we got kind of fish snobs with king salmon. We weren't always about that's, oh, my favorite fish. King salmon was a gift. When you talk about those, I know I'm probably getting off subject. 150 years ago, our ancestors did not fish with these big boats and big engines and 8-inch mesh. They had small boats that they used paddles to set their homemade nets on the side of the river, and it was torn up with a king salmon, and that was the gift. And you fished all summer long. There was no favorite fish. It was all nga food. And so as a kid growing up, the big nets started coming in. The first commercials gathering of king salmon was just beginning in the 60s. And all of a sudden, king salmon, we've got to have our king salmon. Big king salmon make longer strips and more food. And then people would look at chum as, oh, that's dog food. But in early times, you were eating fresh chum all summer, or fresh silvers, or fresh king, or whatever. It was, you know, you were eating whatever was fresh. So what is my favorite? And then let's get back to fish heads, because I was like, with the smelts, I was eating smelt for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, just for a couple of days. And then I couldn't wait till I got my first taste of king. And I think that's why you just, oh my God, it's our first fresh salmon of the year. And you so look forward to it. So I just love that belly. Mm, and I love that head. And so my dad always ate the eyeball, the back of the eyeball, not the retina so much. I thought he ate the whole thing. And this year, for the first time, I'm by myself with my fish head. I'm thinking of my dad, how he loved that eyeball. And I love a lot of different foods, weird foods now. And I ate that back of the eyeball. And it was really delicious. It was like, oh my God. Dad, I ate the damn eyeball. And I told my husband, and I don't know, I just thought it was funny that I, and so I think at 60, I'm going to be 67, I'll eat the eyeball for the rest of my life. So, yeah, but I love bellies. Mm-mm. I love kippered bellies. I loved cold smoked bellies. I love bellies in spaghetti sauce. if anything's a favorite part, I think I love bellies.
So you talked a little bit about the commercial fishing out here. Did you commercial fish?
Commercial fishing changed everything out here. It was a opportunity for people to make some cash. I tried to get a commercial salmon permit. I didn't have enough points because it was all happening when I first moved home. Two of my brothers had commercial fishing permits. And then I started, oh gosh, I knew it was a huge boost to the economy. But then I started listening to some people who were fearful of the future, that maybe someday subsistence and commercial, we couldn't have both. And look what happened. It happened. We couldn't sustain both. And so I appreciated the fact that what I wanted to see with these permits is that people who really needed that cash income would get those permits and keep those permits. What happened was everybody wanted one. And people were making $100,000 a year, had a commercial salmon permit, and were going out. And if there was a disaster, they got money too. You know, so the whole thing was crazy. And I wish that we could have commercial fishing, that it was sustainable, along with subsistence. But I've come to believe that that can't happen on this river at this time. There's too much pressure out in the Bering Sea with the pollock fishery, too much pressure in river, just even with subsistence. And I know I'm going off tangent with you with all of that, but, and that's where I'm at odds with my own people sometimes, of trying to balance both, and I don't think we can.
So the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group started in 1988. Can you, for somebody who doesn't know about that group, can you kind of describe what that group is and why it was formed?
There was a real need back then and still today of our people in this region having a say, an equal say we wanted, as to how the fisheries were going to be managed commercially. It was commercial driven at first. People like John White, a non-native, felt very strongly that people needed a voice. And so those early years of the, those first formative years of the working group was all commercial driven. And commercial seemed to be more important at that time than subsistence. There were more commercial opportunities. Now, of course, you could subsist any time, fish for kings any time. 24-hour openers for king salmon, you know, 24 hours, three times a week, boatloads of all that. And what was your question?
If you could...
the working group. Yeah. Yes. And so that was the early years of the working group. By the time I got on the working group in the early 90s, there was starting to be a shift of, and there was a real struggle between commercial openers and subsistence. And that year, the year I got on, I believe it was 92, 93, we had a chum crash. The chum numbers were the returns. You know, that's a million fish, that chum that we normally expect, anywhere from 700,000 to a million chum coming up this river. Very important part, not just for food source, but just the whole ecosystem of this river and its tributaries. And, of course, we were hollering Area M and False Pass and all of that to anyone who would listen. And the working group all of a sudden became, not only was it becoming a voice for management of the commercial fisheries, but then we were becoming a voice just for fisheries as a whole. And we were realizing that the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group was becoming a voice of what was happening outside in the oceans. And as the commercial fisheries started subsiding, and we realized that for kings now, that, oh my gosh, we can't fish for kings like that. We can't have that bycatch issue on the high seas, and we can't have that pressure river. And wow, those are really emotional moments in time for all of us. It was emotional for the commercial people that wanted to be out there fishing. It was become a part of our way of life. And commercial fishing wasn't always our way of life. It was subsistence first. And then all of a sudden, commercial fishing became it was part of that spiritual ties to the river we talk about, that what the river gives us and why we're out there. And man, those were lots of emotional meetings with the working group. And we were evolving and demanding bigger voices. And we're still demanding that, the working group. I quit after a couple of decades, but I still feel it's important to be active, be outspoken, even with my own people that don't understand why the working group exists. people go, well, it was for commercial. Well, now it's for subsistence. You know, that's how things evolve. That's how we all evolve. You grow. It's an important part of management still today. I know some people would say no, but I say yes.
So what were your roles on the working group over the time you were sort of there?
I'm not a quiet person. I'm kind of I can get kind of radical and outspoken. I try to stay calm. I'm not afraid to ask questions of higher ups or people that think that they know more than me about managing and the knowledge that they get through education. I started off as real interesting. My business, Kuskokwim Wilderness Adventures, we were picking up rafters who were coming down the trip, salmon spawning tributaries, and they were coming down for the trout. And there's a sports seat on there. And somebody called me up and say, we need a sports representative. And I go, well, I'm subsistence first. But we still need a sport. We have all these subsistence people, but we need the sports representative, which that's not a really good seat to be on in this region, because people look at sports fishery as people playing with food, but there I am representing the sports fishery. And I'm like thinking, oh my God. So anyway, that's how I started. And I would always say, my name is Beth Hoffman. I'm the sports seat, but I'm subsistence first. And never had qualms about, no, there will be no fishing for king salmon. Yay, sports fishing, you know, no problems. Because mostly we were looking at, you know, most of our clients were trout. So all of a sudden, I don't know how it happened, I became co-chair. And for many years, I was co-chair, but because I live in Bethel, and the other co-chairs maybe were not living in Bethel at the time, I was chairing a lot of meetings, even towards the end of my tenure on the working group. And that was, I knew it was an important role, but it was a real difficult time because you were trying to educate yourself first, as much knowledge as I could gather about the cycle of the salmon and the importance of escapement. When you're growing up here, never once did I hear, we need to let salmon, we need to let a certain number of salmon go up the river to spawn for sustainability. We never heard that word escapement. I didn't understand escapement and its importance until I sat on the working group. And that's why I think sometimes it's difficult for our people who don't live, if you're not on the fish commission or a working group or involved in fisheries, this is not part of your everyday language. Okay, I'm going to go fishing today, but I'm going to let king salmon go because the numbers are low and we need to meet escapement goals. That's not your normal dialogue. So there I am as a chair, and I hear on talk line radio, UPIC radio, that people are texting me, oh, they're talking about you. You're stopping commercial fishing of king salmon. Me, that, and people are saying, go to the working group meeting, and all of a sudden there's all these commercial fishing people that think that I, as chair, stop commercial fishing. And there was a lot of emotions involved, but I stayed strong. I stayed, you know, a lot of, like I said earlier, I'm not your traditional person. I've mushed dogs almost all my adult life. I'm not just cutting and smoking. I'm out there fishing. I love that part of it as much as I do. So a lot of these men had maybe a difficult time accepting me as a woman, as a chair on the working group, having this strong voice of, look, we're all a part of the solution, and we can't, this is why we can't do this. Our numbers are down. Our elders tell us there's plenty of fish. They know the fish. They know how many fish are going up that river. And I'm saying, where's Bethel test fish? All of these things are important for, along with the knowledge of our elders, are important tools. And people didn't want to hear that. They did not want to, they still don't want to hear it, that we have all these tools, and each of them, every single one of them, are important. Yes, I'd love to see sonar take the place of weirs, because weirs get flooded out, but then look what happened to sonar. The cable got, the bank eroded, and there went the cable, you know? All tools are important, and none are perfect, and we aren't perfect either. In our understanding, and it just really is crazy for me sometimes when I see people like that just want to fish till the last fish is gone. Really, they did that Atlantic, Pacific. We will stop.
Oh, thanks, Jen.
The cap is on the camera.
Right. Why is it broken? Oh.
You're hilarious.
Yep.
So, Bev, you were talking about being on the working group, you wear a lot of different hats. You were sitting on the working group as the sport fish seat, but you're a subsistence user.
Yeah.
And you utilize the fish in many different ways and have many different roles. Tell me about that. Was it challenging? What sort of things did you have to kind of work through?
I think sitting on the working group, and no matter what seat it is challenging. You're the voice to the public. You're the local. You're the person trying to carry the message from that working group meeting. The escapement numbers, the WEIR projects, everything that we work on, you're taking that and passing it out to the public, and it's not always well received. When we started, even when I first got on, it was a challenge. Was I the only woman back then? I think I was the only woman on the whole working group. Back when I first started, and there was a lot of testosterone going, you know, all these guys, we know this, we know that. I mean, I'm not meaning to make fun of all that, but it was sometimes a little too much. Fish and game biologists felt they knew more than the people of the river. The men felt they knew more than I did, or, you know, there was always some kind of challenge there. But you learn to work through that. You learn to work through the challenges, because all of a sudden we all realized on the working group that we were that voice, that things were getting bad, and we were understanding the importance of escapement. So that the importance of conservation, so that a single species might survive, so that our grandchildren's children's children would be able to have that taste of, in this case, king salmon. And so the challenge of trying to share that data, that knowledge, while it was hard, For me, I felt a sense of responsibility to stick my neck out, to be that person to go sit at the radio station and take those calls and remind people that all fish are Naga, not just king salmon, that we're not going to starve. We are not going to starve. We get fish all winter long. We have mammals, caribou and moose and beaver and, you know, birds. And it became such an emotional issue. And we have to do our fish now because of the drying weather is better now. And I kept thinking, well, geez, back in the old days before Western civilization, there was no good weather. It was just weather. And you dried that fish all summer long, bugs and all, rain and all, because that was an important part of the diet for winter, before freezers. The freezers were the in the ground, the frozen tundra would store some of the mud huts, you know, the. And so the working group, being a part of that and feeling that, not just me, but all of us, whether we agreed or we felt this great responsibility, not only to our people, but also to be outspoken to Fish and Game and say, wait a minute, no, we want to make sure upriver people have an opportunity to get their silvers because we're having to count on them because we couldn't fish for king salmon. We want to make sure they get there before you do a commercial opener down here. And they did it anyway. They didn't listen to us. And it was like, well, we really have to be outspoken. And I think that there were Fish and Game staff, people in key positions that were kind of ticked at me for my voice of like asking hard questions and challenging them. And at the same time, trying to keep a sense of calm and civility and respect of, you know, being respectful. At the same time doing that, there were some very difficult days. And I don't mind saying that made me cry right in front of God and everybody, just like, you know, bawl like a baby. Oh, God. See, it's still emotional. I took a cup of coffee.
So, Bev, with all that emotion and those really difficult times, what kept you coming back and serving on the working group and being a voice?
I just felt responsible. I felt it was like, because I was beginning as an adult, I gained not only the knowledge passed on to me from people like Elias and just growing up here, but from people that have that degree in college that study salmon cycles. And I felt that that it was important for at least two decades and still today to be able to take that and tell people about it. Seemed like I could spout off numbers just like that about, well, I do know how many king salmon are expected to go up the river, and I do know how many are expected to spawn, and I do know. And so as things would get more emotional, as we got more and more restricted with king salmon, it became harder, but I still felt it important. And my family would say, as they saw how emotional it was and is, say, this is too much, too much. And I say, I can't quit. I know too much. Isn't that silly? I know too much. You know, like all of a sudden I became like... But it wasn't that I knew too much. It's just that I could see that we were really having a hard time as a people, as a department, as a state, managing our fish for sustainability, and that people like myself and James Charles and Bob Aloysius and Ray Kahn, all these people that devote so many hours, unlike Fish and Game, they get paid to sit there. Volunteering, oh gosh, in my life, hundreds of hours to be the messenger of sometimes really bad news, you know. The question was, why did I stay with it? Or why is it, it's important for, even though I'm off, I'm still on the list. I still get the information. I still look at Bethel test fish. I still look at, now I'm getting angry about, you know, the high seas fishery again. I still think that's a big issue, even though they've done all this stuff. My knowledge of what was going on out there started with information from the working group. And they could put all their hot spots, they could put all their innovations. The bottom line is there's still huge fleets taking huge numbers out of the Bering Sea, and it is affecting us. And so still there's, you know, you'll see everybody pointing at, oh, those high seas fishermen, oh, those commercial fishermen in river, oh, those subsistence fishermen that they don't care, they just want to get their 200 king salmon. Oh, though, we're all a part of the solution. We have to be. Especially when you see countries, and even our own country, the United States of America, they fished out the Atlantic, they fished out the Pacific. Human beings, we did that. We wrecked the habitat. We're really sometimes, human beings, we really suck, you know? I mean, it's the truth. And why do I care more than somebody else? I don't know how that happened, how that evolved. Some of us care to understand. We care to get the knowledge. We care to sacrifice. And that's why this year, king salmon still are important to me. Because it's a bigger fish head? I don't know. You know, it's just, it's still an important part of my diet. Yet, what am I stripping these days? Chums and reds. And very few kings. Very, very few kings anymore. We used to put up 80 to 100. And I think this year we put up 8. You know, and I already forgot the question again. Something about the working group.
Can you pull the mic? It kind of works under your...
Okay.
There we go.
Alrighty.
Thanks.
So you mentioned some of the people that serve on the working group or have served on the working group. People all the way down from Eek, all the way up to Nikolai and the Headwaters.
Yeah.
What was that like, being with talking, having these discussions with people from the entire river?
Oh, gosh, yeah. So important. All of a sudden, you know, one of my roles, too, as a chair was, no, as we were seeing the decline of kings, it's not an upriver, downriver thing. We're all a part of the solution. And that's when I think... that dialogue started, like, oh, upriver people would get so angry because the bigger population down here taking most of the fish were Bethel area from Tulixac on down to the coast. And there were working group meetings where I was having to stop right now, and you stop that tone and be more respectful. Be more respectful. It's not an upriver, downriver thing. We're all a part of the same river system. We're important to each other. And upriver people, any of us that live along the river, unless you've been in those tributaries, unless you've seen spawning salmon, you don't get it. You don't get it. And so the more we can get that footage out of spawning salmon, even like on YouTube, the McNeil River and those fish, you know, being caught by those bears, unless you see it where they go to spawn, and unless you see those carcasses on the side of the river spawning out after they've laid their eggs, you don't get it. And that's why this whole outreach and education of young people is so, so important. From it just can't be taught enough, because we want this generation not to grow up as ignorant as mine did about the importance of escapement. Yeah. I already forgot your question again.
So thinking about the people that you served with on the working group,
yes,
it was all voluntary. Right. No, like you said, no one's paid to be on the working group. Is there a connection you feel with the folks who have served on the working group?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, and there was both Native and non-Native people. It was very diverse in that way, men and women towards the end, more women involved. And I, you know, I just truly enjoyed listening to Charlie. He wanted commercials so bad, but yet he understood that the importance of subsistence. James Charles, too. I look at James as my guru, sort of. You know, he's, when I tell people I feel this way, and talk to James if you don't feel, believe me. And then, you know, people that always tried to keep us in line, Robert's Rules of Order, would be Bob Aloysius. You know, it just, and then to have folks like Barb Carlson come on board with her very even, stated, she's so calm and articulated the needs of upriver and gave the lower river a better understanding of that need. And I just, in the last, oh, say, let me see, 2010 is when we started seeing the decline of Kings. It's when I really began to appreciate each individual on the working group, because they, each of them had so much to offer. And it was really interesting as we started to become the voice of to save the king salmon from losing. We already lost that big gene, the big king gene pool. It's going to be forever before we see those big kings. But we became the voice of how important it is for sustainability, and that brought us closer, a lot closer together. We started, when people started talking about the Fish Commission and the four-legged stool and Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Game, the working group, and then this Fish Commission, and I was really concerned. But it's all a part of the process. How did I get my knowledge? How's the Fish Commission going to get their knowledge? Through presentations, through dialogue between people from upriver and downriver, between the working group and Fish Commission, the RAC groups, the Fish and Game data, the Fish and Wild, you know, it's all a part and so important. And I just really appreciated more and more, all of us. You know, just there's sometimes I would just go nuts with some biologists, and then there's sometimes I'd just go nuts with my own people about the lack of understanding by any of us of what it's going to take to save our king salmon. And that is going to take years till we see the numbers. And it might not ever happen because of things like that are not out of our control, but like climate change. A lot of that part of it is human caused, and some of it isn't. It's just a cycle. It's complicated, and it always will be.
Where do you see the working group in the future?
Boy, I hope it continues to exist as an entity, a part of the four-legged stool in management. The Fish Commission came about because the state refused to allow the working group members, the people of the river, to co-manage. They had the final say. And that was so irritating to myself and others. And even though I was concerned about what's going to happen to the working group with the Fish Commission, actually I see them intertwining and very important to each other. You don't get rid of this group of knowledge and replace it with this group. You're all working together, and I think the working group, as long as there's a Department of Fish and Game that and Fish and Wildlife, that there should be the working group where there's a need to be that voice, to pass the knowledge on to each other. I like to think some of these new young biologists that are coming up are more tuned in than some of the old guard, so to speak, that they just want to be in charge. Well, we just want to be in charge. Well, hello, we all have to work together. You know, we just have to. It's important. It's not a Yupik Gusuk thing. We all live here. It's important for like my people, the Yupik part of me, to understand we could lose it all because of our own lack of understanding of salmon cycle, life cycle, and we can lose it all. And it's the working group that continues to be the voice, and the Fish Commission, those commissioners are getting up to speed. There's misinformation sometimes, even of our own people, that there's still people that think salmon spawn, they lay their eggs, and they just go right back out to the ocean. And it's not true. Only place that is true a little bit is on the Atlantic. There are cases where some salmon do spawn and go back out and come back. Nowhere else. Not on this river, not in this region. And to hear that still today shows me that there's still so much more work that needs to be done. That really sharp people say to me, my elders told me, and I stop them and I go, I said, no, my elders tell me, and I refer to James Charles, and I refer to Lucy Crowe, and I refer to... And then now as I'm getting to be an elder, I'm going, this elder says, you know, this is what I know, and I'm comfortable being that voice. I'm comfortable saying those things, whether it's received well or not.
So as we're kind of wrapping up here, what's your hope for the future?
Oh, God, world peace.
It's a loaded question.
I know. My wish is that through our sacrifices and through our willingness to work together, that we will enjoy subsistence king, subsistence chum, subsistence silver, subsistence any kind of food for generations to come, that it won't happen unless we continue to work together and educate ourselves, not just about the way it always has been, but as we see things happening, why is that happening? Why did we lose our fish? Was, you know, just to have a openness and clear understanding of why these things happen, so that our grandchildren's children's children will enjoy that first salmon that comes up the Kuskokwim is king salmon. And then there's chum salmon. And then there's silver salmon. And that chum is as delicious as kings and silvers and reds. It's all good food.
Well, Bev, I just want to thank you for visiting with us today and for all the work you've done over your lifetime around the fishery and continue to do.
Yeah.
We just really appreciate you visiting with us. Is there anything you want to add before we end today?
No, I just keep up the good work that you're doing, and we all need to keep doing good things and be kinder. Be more aware, be more vigilant, be kind.
Well, thank you, Bev.
Thanks, Bev.